From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. Visit them on the web at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hello, and welcome to episode 27 of the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. I am your host and Diz historian, Michael Bowling, and I am joined by my co-host and producer, Craig Williams. Craig, how are you today?
I'm doing just great. How are you, Michael?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thanks. I thought of you when I was at the Walt Disney Family Museum this past week because they are having an exhibit on Disney movie posters from the 1960s.
Oh, that's exciting.
It was very cool. I'll have to post some up on my Facebook page.
Oh, that's awesome. But
it was amazing how many great films and goofy films came out, you know, in the 60s.
Oh, yeah. Did they include live action releases too?
Yes, a lot of them were live action. The vast majority of them were.
That's cool. I like a lot of the 60s live action movies.
Yeah, so. You know, That Darn Cat and, you know, then they even had some from Europe up there.
Oh, really?
As well, yeah. And, you know, they had, you know, the Flubber, you know, films. And in some of the re-releases that came out, you know, they had Summer Magic was
very
up
nice.
There.
Yeah,
which is one of my favorite films.
I think my favorite movie from that time period, actually, is Miracle of the White Stallions. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, I did. I saw it when... But I saw it on... Oh, you know what? I saw it when they used to show films in schools. You know, we'd have a free day.
Yeah.
And so they would, like, you know, rent a film like Big Red.
Yes,
which is actually, I think, one of them that they had up. And things like that. And that was one of them.
Yeah, the first time I got to watch it, I knew nothing about it. But when Kylie and I went to Europe, and the last part of our little Adventures by Disney trip, where we went to Vienna, part of that stay in Vienna was we were going to see the Viennese waltzing horses, which are the
Lipizzan stallions.
Yeah, the
Lipizzans.
Yep. Yeah, and so we, you know, we got to watch the movie while we're driving through the countryside of Austria, which is one of those things that you just can't ever forget. So just because of that, that's quickly become one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, yeah. And then they had, when Fantasia was re-released in the 60s, you could tell from that film poster what... the crowd they were, they were catering to.
Oh, I can imagine. So
it's that Peter Max, you know, style of art.
Oh yeah,
that was popular back then. So anyway, you know, and speaking of reaching back and memories and all that, in today's episode, Craig and I are going to explore the deepest reaches of the Magic Kingdom's Adventureland. Now, since all of the opening day attractions for this realm were adaptations of Disneyland attractions, I'm not going to go into the history of their development and design on this show. If you would like to learn more about the origins of these attractions, I would encourage you to listen to my 60 Years of Disneyland series on the Diz Unplugged podcast, Disneyland Edition. And there's a list of my Disneyland history episodes on the Disboards. And Craig, would you mind posting a link to that in our show notes?
Absolutely. I'd be more than happy to.
Excellent. Great. Thank you. And there's some of my other history segments on there, too, that don't necessarily relate to Disneyland.
But still good.
But they're on there.
Yeah.
So now let's begin our exploration by going back to the opening day of Disneyland. And let's remember Walt's dedication speech that introduced us to the mysterious realm of Adventureland. Here is adventure. Here is romance. Here is mystery. Tropical rivers flowing silently into the unknown, the unbelievable splendor of exotic flowers, the eerie sounds of the jungle, with eyes that are always watching. This is Adventureland. Now, Craig, I think you'll agree that Adventureland is the most exotic and lush of any realm at Disneyland or the Magic Kingdom.
Oh, I completely agree. And part of that is why it is my favorite land in Magic Kingdom, not necessarily out in Disneyland. We've talked about that already on one show way, way back, and how despite it being beautiful at Disneyland, there's a bit of a congestion problem that takes away from some of the enjoyment of it. But, you know, we don't have that problem here at the Magic Kingdom. And I love everything about it, from the plant life that's surrounding and the design of the buildings and then the area background music. It all just comes together and it really transports you. That's why, you know, if I'm just going into the Magic Kingdom at my own leisure and not going in for work or anything in particular, I'm the type of person, I always have to start out going left and I go straight into Adventureland.
Yeah, I agree. At the Magic Kingdom, Adventureland is my favorite land. You know, and part of it is because I'm a gardener. So, you know, there's Cape honeysuckle, Chinese hibiscus, Mexican flame vines, Brazilian bougainvillea, sword fern, spider plants, and Australian tree ferns are just some of the plants that thrive in the Magic Kingdom's Adventureland. So no other realm at the Magic Kingdom combines so many diverse locales. There's Polynesia, Africa, the Caribbean, Southeast Asia, and the Middle East. And much of this is achieved not only through the architecture, but by the complex and inspired landscape that's designed by Imagineer and Disney legend Morgan Bill Evans. Now, the story and theme for Adventureland is established before guests enter the realm with the placement of a large volcanic rock planter near the entrance to this area. The towering palms suggest the tropical atmosphere of the realm. And behind these palms is a lush, unexplored jungle that's enticing guests to explore further. Now, the bridge into Adventureland, which had originally been arched to allow for a grand reveal to guests as they crossed, was flattened in 2011, and that adds to the tropical theme. Now, this realm reminds us of several Disney films. Many of these are my very favorites. In Search of the Castaways, The Jungle Book, Swiss Family Robinson, Aladdin, Treasure Island, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, and Walt Disney's True Life Adventure series.
Yes.
So maybe In Search of the Castaways might be a bit of a stretch, but it's there is no set time period for this realm, as there is in the other realms of the Magic Kingdom. For instance, the magic carpets of Aladdin are set in 400 BC. Pirates of the Caribbean are set in the 1600s. The Swiss Family Treehouse is the early 1800s. The Jungle Cruise is the 1930s. And the Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room is the 1960s and 70s.
And the best part is, it never really sticks out that it is jumping around all these times. While I think you and I would both agree that maybe not all of these attractions naturally fit into the area. While they don't do that, in terms of the time periods, you never really question it. Almost like being over at Universal at the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, and you don't question the time period there that clearly bounces around different books and movies. You just live in it, and it's really nice.
Right, and except for one area that we'll get into, I think a lot of that just has to do with the landscaping and the architecture that just sort of gradually changes as you walk through, you know, this land.
Yeah.
So now, after crossing over the bridge, guests are transported to another world. The air is more humid due to the lushness and denseness of the tropical foliage. Buildings line each side of the walkway, and on the first level of the buildings are shops and restaurants. Businesses and residences seem to occupy the upper levels of the buildings, and heavy shutters protect windows from the hurricane-force winds common to the tropics, and the balconies and red clay tile roofs add to the tropical feel of the buildings. Now, if you visited Adventureland on opening day, October 1st, 1971, the attractions you would have seen was the Swiss Family Island Treehouse, which was a B ticket. Island was removed from the name in later years. The Safari Club Arcade, the Jungle Cruise, which was an E ticket, and Tropical Serenade, which was also an E ticket. There were restaurants and snack areas, counter service you could enjoy, included the Adventureland Veranda, the Veranda Juice Bar, and the Sunshine Tree Terrace. And you could shop at the Adventureland Bazaar, the Tiki Tropic Shop, the Magic Carpet, Oriental Imports Limited, and Tropic Toppers. Now, the first attraction guests encounter after crossing the bridge from the hub is the Swiss Family Robinson Island Treehouse, or now it's just the Treehouse. This attraction is based on the 1812 book by Johann David Weiss and the 1960 live-action Disney film. Now, this tree was not planted by Imagineer Bill Evans, but it was created by Imagineers. This 200-ton steel, concrete, and stucco tree has a foundation extending 42 feet and is covered with 800,000 fabricated leaves, flowers, and buds on its 600 branches, and is draped with living Spanish moss. And only four of these trees are known to exist. So, this is quite an engineering feat when you really think about it.
Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah. So, we're all just lucky that it was an engineering feat at the time that it was, because it would never be built today because of the obvious ADA accessible problems with it. So, that's why there's always been talk of rumors floating around that one day the treehouse is going to be removed because of that, but it doesn't matter which side you fall on that. It's Swiss Family Treehouse is just it's a spectacular work of engineering.
Absolutely, yeah. And what they had to go through, because we have to keep in mind, the utilidors are beneath there.
Yeah.
So they had to, they couldn't have this concrete and steel and all that all hanging there. And this is true throughout Adventureland. So that they had to have, special, planting boxes, built into the ground for the treehouse, but also for all of the trees and foliage throughout Adventureland to contain all the roots and everything that, they wouldn't be, encroaching upon the utilidors.
Yeah.
So, now the Magic Kingdom's tree is modeled after the banyan tree, which is common in Florida. Unlike the tree in Disneyland, which is modeled after a Moreton Bay fig tree, which was found growing in Anaheim, not far from Disneyland. Now, this rare Disneyodendron eximus is the deserted island home for the Robinson family. And the Imagineers authentically recreated the home the shipwrecked family in the film built for themselves from materials they salvaged from their wrecked ship, the Swallow. And the Swiss flag flying over the Swiss Family Treehouse is the only flag of another nation that's permanently flown over an attraction in the Magic Kingdom. And as you climb the steps of the Swiss Family Treehouse, you pass through the various rooms with plaques telling the story of the Robinsons. You get close-up views of each of the rooms, which feature furnishings from items salvaged from the Swallow. Ropes from the ship drive a water wheel system that brings water up to the treehouse in bamboo cups from the stream, carrying the water to the top of the tree. And once the water reaches the various rooms in the house, bamboo pipes funnel the water into barrels. This still fascinates me.
Yeah, it does. It's just memories of being a child and being fascinated by it, just watching, mm-hmm. watching this really simple, feat just over and over again and being baffled by it.
Yeah, it's so ingenious.
Yeah,
and this tree, it makes me realize if I was on a deserted island, I would just die.
Yeah,
I could never make something like this. Yeah. So, the family's pipe organ merrily plays the Swiss Polka, which was written by Buddy Baker, and the treehouse looks as if the Robinsons may return at any moment. At the base of the tree, guests are first given the backstory to the Swiss Family Treehouse. There's a plaque that reads, "Swiss Family Robinson, composed of myself, my good wife, and three sons, Fritz, Ernst, and little Francis, were the sole survivors by the grace of God of the ill-fated ship Swallow. From the wreckage we built our home, this tree for protection on this uncharted shore, Franz." I always noticed that the wife, he never named her on his little plaque here.
Oh, yeah.
As you climb through the tree across suspended bridges and staircases, you can view the rooms of the treehouse, including the master bedroom, with a retracting skylight. That was something else I always thought was cool.
Yeah, yeah.
The boys' bedroom and the kitchen. At the top of the tree, you can look out onto Adventureland below and take in the view of the winding river of the Jungle Cruise, and which then lends the feeling of being in the middle of a tropical island. So, Craig, is the Swiss Family Robinson or Swiss Family Treehouse an attraction you visit or walk by?
Oh, it's 100% an attraction that I actually visit, much to mm-hmm. my wife's chagrin. As I just said, as a kid, I was fascinated by the simple water mechanisms that was in here, but it was everything about it. I must have did the attraction first before I watched Swiss Family Robinson at home, because, you know, to this day, it's another one of those Disney movies that is just ingrained in me. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love it. I think it is one of the best live action movies that Disney ever made. And the Swiss Family Treehouse just still embodies that movie so well. And despite the fact that I'm sure we would all die off if we had to be deserted and try to come up with a treehouse like this on our own, it still is so cool to see it and be able to imagine that you could be doing this, especially as a kid. Again, like seeing the boys, how they would sleep in hammocks instead mm-hmm. of a bed, stuff like that. This is one of those things that it's like, it's the dream of a childhood kid that never got the treehouse that they wanted. So now they can go and walk in this massive one that is just larger than life.
Oh, I know. Didn't you always want it to be able to spend the night in it? Magic Kingdom.
Still would. I'm sure that I'm sure that the bed in the master bedroom is probably just made of plywood, but I think it would be worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, do you prefer the Magic Kingdom Swiss Family Treehouse or Disneyland's Tarzan Treehouse?
Definitely Swiss Family Treehouse. I mean, first and foremost, for nostalgia reasons and the fact that I do love Swiss Family Robinson so much. And I'm honestly not a huge fan of the animated Tarzan movie. It's starting to grow on me a little bit more. I'm starting to finally be okay with the Phil Collins soundtrack to it. But honestly, the Disneyland's Tarzan Treehouse, it actually has a little bit of meaning for me too, because the first time I got to experience it was actually with my wife. And that's, in terms of Disneyland attractions, that's very rare because of going out once as I was when I was a kid with my family. I did a lot of things then, and then my first trip back after all those years was with work, and I just wanted to go and do as much as I could as fast as I could. But Tarzan Treehouse was one of those ones I didn't hit on either of those trips. I'm pretty sure it would have been around the first trip I had out there. I'm not sure if it was already switched. It was close. Might have still been Swiss Family the first time I went out, but regardless, because I got to experience it with my wife, and she got terrified when you first get up to the top, and the is it a jaguar or the cat? Mm-hmm. Just she got the timing perfectly where the cat jumps out. It doesn't jump, it's always there, but the sound goes off. And I will never forget her almost falling off the side of the treehouse because of how scared she was. So they're both good, but Swiss Family wins.
Yeah, I agree. I prefer the Cecily Robinson treehouse just because I loved the film as a boy. It got me to read the book.
Yeah,
which is a little different from the film, I think that film holds up well. I don't think it needs to be remade.
Absolutely.
And it's funny. Cecily Robinson Treehouse was the very first Magic Kingdom attraction my wife and I went on in our honeymoon.
Oh, that's sweet.
So yeah. So and I don't think she's been on it since. Yeah. But anyway,
there's a lot of people that walk right past it.
No, I love it. I try to go on it every time.
Yeah.
So now, after descending the treehouse, let's walk over to the adjacent Jungle Cruise. Now, this was another popular Disneyland attraction adapted for the Magic Kingdom. And this attraction was inspired by a couple of films. The 1951 film, The African Queen, based on the novel by C.S. Forrester, and it starred Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn. Hepburn is a missionary named Rose Sayer. She's traveling with her brother, Samuel Sayer, who's played by Robert Morley, to the African interior to convert the natives. Bogart is Charlie Alnett, who is responsible for transporting the missionaries on board his boat, the African Queen. Unfortunately, World War I breaks out, and the travelers must avoid Germans, river rapids, waterfalls, animals, native tribes, and other jungle dangers on their trek. This attraction is also inspired by Walt Disney's 1955 true life adventure documentary, The African Lion, which follows a lion through the course of his life on the jungle savanna. Now, the African Lion inspired Walt Disney to create a boat attraction through the rivers of the jungles of the world. Walt, though, wanted to use live animals, but he was discouraged from doing so by designer and Imagineer Harper Goff, who loved the African Queen, which is why the boats look as they do.
Yes.
So when Walt learned that they would be the animals would be unreliable and prone to sleep during the day and shy away from the gaze of guests, Walt opted for audio animatronic stand-ins. And the 10-minute safari takes guests along the Irrawaddy River of Burma, Cambodia's Mekong, the Egyptian Nile, the African Congo, and the rapids of Kilimanjaro. And along the way, guests see and experience abandoned temples, native villages, and jungle animals, including lions, giraffes, hippos, crocodiles, elephants, gorillas, and monkeys.
And sadly, no piranhas.
No piranhas. No, that is at Disneyland, those piranhas. So, as realistic as they are.
Love them.
I do too. Now, aside from appearing to be more spread out over a larger area, not very much about the Magic Kingdom's Jungle Cruise is different from the Disneyland original. The Magic Kingdom's Jungle Cruise is set in the 1920s and 30s during the age of African and Asian imperialism. The queue building in the dock area in 1971 appeared similar to Disneyland's, except it was wider. As for the attraction, there was a series of scene variations between Disneyland and Walt Disney World, and they were evident as the Magic Kingdom boats cruised through the Amazon, Nile, Congo, and Mekong rivers. Several new scenes were designed specifically for the Magic Kingdom. In Disneyland, the cruise began by going past Asian ruins that were conspicuously absent in the Magic Kingdom until the final third of the journey. That's when guests at the Magic Kingdom came upon a flooded Cambodian temple, which made Disneyland's crumbling columns and ancient statuary seem a bit understated, in comparison.
Yeah.
Now, the Magic Kingdom's Jungle Cruise was intended to be an upgraded version of Disneyland's that would also handle a larger number of guests. It added roughly 1 minute's worth of additional trip time over Disneyland's 9-minute expedition and included two more boat launches. A more significant difference in the Magic Kingdom's version was that Imagineer and Disney legend Mark Davis was the primary designer of the overall experience. Whilst at Disneyland, his influence was not imprinted on the attraction until 1964, when vignettes demonstrating Mark's comical touch were added in the form of the Indian elephant bathing pool, the rhinoceros and trap safari, and an expanded African veld. Now, those same scenes appeared in the Magic Kingdom, but they were mixed in with a number of all-new elements that included Inspiration Falls, giant butterflies, pygmy war canoes, gorillas ransacking a safari camp, a huge python, a Bengal tiger, cobras guarding ancient treasure, and a family of monkeys fondling the same loot. Now, each of the 15 Jungle Cruise launches has a unique name. They are Amazon Annie, Bomakandi Bertha, Congo Connie, Ganges Gertie, Irrawaddy Irma, Quango Kate, Mongala Millie, Nile Nelly, Orinoco Ida. some of these are tough.
Yeah.
They don't just roll off the tongue. Sankuru Sadie, Senegal Sal. Oh, here's a good one. Yuka Lali Lali, Volta Val, Wamba Wanda, and Zambezi Zelda. Now, Craig, this is another original attraction. It hasn't changed significantly since its 1955 original. Do you think this attraction has held up well over the generations?
This is where you really start to separate the diehard Disney fans from the casual fan. You know, there's nothing more awkward than being one of those people who just absolutely loves the Jungle Cruise, as I am, and I'm sure you are too. If it wasn't for the fact that it had such a line, this would be in every single time I visit the park attraction, something that I'd have to do, like another one of the attractions that we'll be talking about very shortly here. I absolutely love it. I love the corniness of the skippers, even though the jokes are pretty much always the same. Every now and then, you know, you get a little bit of the ad lib in, and but for the most part, it remains this attraction that if you get into it as a passenger in the boat, then that helps push the skipper to get into it too, and it becomes this absolute memorable experience. And there is nothing more painfully awkward than being on a boat full of people who just don't get it. They understand the jokes. They get the jokes. They just kind of cringe at it all. They don't see it like a lot of these diehard fans do. And for that kind of reason, I almost have to say it's starting to not hold up. You know, and I've even seen this shift come over the past couple of years where you start seeing people, you know, if they get bored, they're on their phones instantly looking through.
That's sad.
And you know, for me, I am captivated by every second, unless I have a camera in my hand, which I do a lot. I will always pull up my camera on the Jungle Cruise, no matter how many times I do it. But it's, you know, it's just one of those things where I am into every single moment of it, and I'm seeing more and more that people just aren't grasping onto it like they were before. And this, you know, I don't think there needs to be any changes. I just, if anything, I would hope that the people who are visiting the parks can open their minds a little more and realize that, you know, this isn't, I will never belittle my love for Universal, but it's not a Universal park. It's not a Six Flags. It's not right in the moment. There are some history. There's a little bit of history and some, you know, a little bit of nuance to some of these attractions. And I would say the Jungle Cruise is the perfect example of that. You have to invest a little bit into it to get a lot of it back.
Yeah, I agree. And I love both Jungle Cruise attractions. I like Disneyland's because, you know, the rivers there are narrower. So the jungle, it's like it's coming over you. It's enveloping you a little more than I think at the Magic Kingdom. But I like the Magic Kingdom's because it is a little, it's a longer experience. You have more of Mark Davis's humor in there. There's more scenes in there. I love the ruined Cambodian temple. I know we've talked about this. I don't know if we talked about it on the show or just, you know, in our, when we've been in the park together. I just love that where you go through there in that darkness.
And that's why I just don't like that. But and that's why I think it's a tough one. I like the playfulness of ours. We definitely have that over Disneyland, but something about Disneyland's just connects too. I'd say you hit it right on the head with it is much more intimate than ours is, and I enjoy that. But no, both two different complete experiences, and this is one of those ones where you can't say, oh well, I've done it at Disney World, so I don't need to worry about it at Disneyland, and vice versa. You have to experience both of them, really.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And the one time that I've seen people not get into it is I happened to get in a boat where there were a lot of international travelers at the Magic Kingdom. So I don't think they had a good enough command of English to understand the jokes. So they just sat there completely stone-faced. Yes. And the poor skipper was just sweating. And I'm laughing. And I'm like the only one.
Yeah, no, I've been on many cruises like that, unfortunately, and that's part of that awkwardness that I was talking about, but I can't remember, it was probably 2003, 2004, it might have honestly been right before Hong Kong Disneyland opened. I believe they might have been trying to train. I'm not sure if the Jungle Cruise is in Hong Kong Disneyland or if it was just a mix-up with college program putting where they were placing people. But bless her heart, we had this this Asian skipper who probably didn't know more than 10 words in English. And so she didn't do any of the script the entire time. We just kept circling around, and every about 15-20 seconds she would just say, "Still having fun?" And
oh dear,
nothing else. And it's one of those things, every trip afterwards for like the next couple years, we would just, you know, it was that inside joke that we made with our family, and I had extended family there too. And, you know, anytime we'd see each other, still having fun, because that's all the poor girl could say.
And, oh, that's hilarious.
Jungle Cruise is always interesting, whether it's the people on your boat or the skipper you get.
Yeah, that's true. Now, a Christmas overlay was added to the Jungle Cruise in 2013. And the attraction was renamed the Jingle Cruise at Disneyland and Walt Disney World. And much like the attractions themselves, they are similar but different in the overlay elements and the skipper spiels. The backstory for the Jingle Cruise is the skippers have grown homesick for the holidays, so they've added holiday cheer to the Jungle Cruise queue and boathouse with decorations that have been mailed to them from home, plus a few they've created themselves. The skippers have also added a slew of new jokes to their tours that are the perfect way to get guests in the holiday spirit. Additionally, Jungle Cruise boats have been renamed with the holidays in mind. And if you listen carefully, they may hear a holiday-themed radio broadcast playing in the background. Now, the 15 Jungle Cruise launches are renamed for the Jingle Cruise. So Amazon Annie is renamed Eggnog Annie. Bomakandi Bertha, which is wheelchair equipped, is renamed Burr Bertha. Congo Connie is renamed Candy Cane Connie. Ganges Gertie is renamed Garland Gertie. Irrawaddy Irma is renamed Icicle Irma. Mongla Millie is renamed Mistletoe Millie. Nile Nelly is renamed Noel Nelly. Orinoco Ida is renamed Orinococo Ida. Now, some of the boats have clearly gone through some name changes over the years. Because Rutshuru Ruby, which was not one of the original names, is renamed Reindeer Ruby. Sankuru Sadie is renamed Sleigh Ride Sadie. Senegal Sal is renamed Poinsettia Sal. Ukayali Lolly is renamed Yule Log Lolly. Volta Val is renamed Vixen Val. Wamba Wanda, that's also wheelchair lift equipped, is renamed Wassail Wanda. And Zambezi Zelda, I don't get this name, Fruitcake Zelda. That doesn't even have the iteration or the, you know, the, I don't know.
So anyway. Z's always get it.
Yeah, I know. I guess Zelda's a little crazy. Now, Craig, does the Jingle Cruise overlay make you feel merry or like a humbug?
Hello, this is tough. The honest truth is, at Disneyland, Jingle Cruise is everything. I would almost take Jingle Cruise year round in Disneyland. I love it. You know, the first year, both at Disneyland and Walt Disney World, it was pretty much just kept strictly to the line. The queue was changed up, and a bit of the narration for the attraction. Obviously, the spiel was holiday related, and then it progressed to where Disneyland just went all out with it, and it became a thing where entertainment actually took over it completely and said, we want to do it, much like they have done with Small World during the holidays and Haunted Mansion holiday. Disneyland Entertainment is just, they're geniuses when it comes to this stuff. And unfortunately, Magic Kingdom's Jingle Cruise just hasn't been given the same amount of love, where we have started to add in some of the Christmas elements throughout the ride. It's just, it doesn't compare. It feels almost like an afterthought here, or like, we have to do more. We have to put in a little bit of the decorations and all of that throughout the attraction, and it just doesn't live up. And the other part too with it, and you know, I could be wrong on this, but because our Jungle Cruise has a lot more college program cast members working there, I feel like they struggle because you know, they'll come in. If they're extended on their program, they might come in the beginning of summer and stay all throughout the holiday season. Otherwise, they came in sometime between August and September, and they're just getting a real good handle on their scripts through September, October, and then come November, they have to get thrown on with the Jingle Cruise too and learn a brand new script and really get into it. And I just feel like you can tell who doesn't really pick up on it. So, love Jingle Cruise at Disneyland. Walt Disney World they need to either drop it or they need to put a little bit more effort into it.
Yeah, I agree that Disneyland's is definitely stronger in theme and spiel. Yeah. The last time I was on a Jingle Cruise was at the Magic Kingdom. And, you know, definitely the skipper's spiel was lacking. She relied more on singing Christmas carols than an actual spiel. And I attributed some of it. It was late and it was cold. And they don't seem to issue the Jungle Cruise skippers heavy jackets as part of their costume as they do at Disneyland.
No.
There's heavy jackets for all the cast members that go with their costumes throughout the park. And I don't see that at the Magic Kingdom.
I've had very close friends who are skippers, and you know, the just horror stories they would tell on those cold, cold nights. Granted, we don't get a lot of those in Florida. You know, maybe 10 or 20 throughout winter, but those nights where it gets into the 30s or the very low 40s, and they have to be out on that boat all through the night, all through extra magic hours or party hours, and they just suffer, and I feel so bad for them.
Yeah, because the skippers were shivering. I mean, so it was a chilly night. Yeah. So I thought, okay, maybe that was part of it. But anyway, but it is a fun. It's nice that they change it up.
Yes, agree.
Yeah. Now the portico that connects Frontierland and Adventureland has not changed much over time, as are the restrooms, and the west side still opens into the space now occupied by the island supply company. There were two earlier tenants in that shop. The first was the Safari Club Arcade for guests wishing to go on electronic hunting safaris, and that closed in early 1972. The second was Colonel Hathi's Safari Club, a shop that lasted much longer until 1990, when it was replaced by the Island Supply Company. At that time, the merchandise went from a tropical clothing and sundry selection to one of anything vaguely outdoor or nature-related. Island Supply is now a venue for Sunglass Hut.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yes.
The architecture in Adventureland changes its theme as we continue deeper into the land. You'll notice that the buildings closest to the hub entrance denote a modern Caribbean feel. The architecture motif changes with each section of the land. So across the path from the Jungle Cruise is a very different animal show. Originally, the Tropical Serenade, Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room, defines the architecture for Adventureland. The 9-tiered thatched pagoda tower acts as the weenie, drawing guests deeper into the land. The tower is topped with carvings of gazelle and water buffalo, and the species of water buffalo was chosen because they are visible from Frontierland and could be taken as longhorn steer when viewed from that land, thus keeping with the theme of the Old West. The interiors of the peaks of the thatched roofs have colorful designs of faces and ocean creatures, characteristic of the South Pacific Island cultures of the Maori in New Zealand and the native Hawaiians. Nearby is a small circular area lined by 6 wooden tiki god statues known as the Leaky Tikis. On your next visit, stand in front of the tikis to hear each one play its own distinctive tribal drum rhythm, and you may find the overall experience surprising and refreshing. Now, the original Enchanted Tiki Room premiered at Disneyland in 1963, and it was the very first audio animatronic attraction. The Magic Kingdom's version is similar to the original. When guests entered the theater, they were delighted by walls lined with wooden carved tiki gods, hanging baskets filled with flowers, and perches with tropical birds suspended from the ceiling. The musical show, hosted by 4 parrots, Jose, Fritz, Michael, and Pierre, voiced by Disney legends Thurl Ravenscroft, Wally Bogue, Fulton Burley, along with actor Jerry Orbach. And the 17-minute show featured songs by the birds, flowers, and tikis, sometimes in the singing styles of Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby. And our younger listeners may have to Google those names.
Yeah.
The theme song in the Tiki 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 Room was composed by Richard and Robert Sherman. In the early 1980s, the thatched roof of the show building was replaced with a rusted metal look that remained until 1992. From 1971 to 1986, the attraction was sponsored by the Florida Orange Growers Industry Association, and the animatronic Barker Toucan sat outside the theater trying to talk guests into seeing the show with a hilarious Spanish accent, and it was voiced by Wally Bogue. It was referred to as the Orange Bird for a time. After the sponsorship ended, he was replaced in 1992 by a new bird with a Caribbean accent named Artemis, who flew away in 1997. Most likely in anticipation of what was coming next for the Enchanted Tiki Room. In an example of corporate synergy that was a hallmark of the Michael Eisner era, this Tiki Room was reimagined in 1988 as the Enchanted Tiki Room under new management. And this performance starred the parrot Iago from the Disney film Aladdin and the toucan Zazu from The Lion King. For some inexplicable reason, Iago and Zazu have purchased the Enchanted Tiki Room and are its new owners, who want to update the show. However, Iago ends up offending the Tiki gods and is scorched as punishment. This reimagined version of the Enchanted Tiki Room was the first change to Adventureland in 25 years. Now, Craig, did you see the original version of the show and the reimagined version?
I definitely had to have seen the original show version at some time, but I just honestly, I don't remember ever seeing it. I listened to the soundtrack of the original all the time. I absolutely love it with the Offenbach number in there. It's, you know, I listen to the version that's off the 50th anniversary of Disneyland through the years, and you know, of all the songs I've listened to on that album, I'm sure the Enchanted Tiki Room has probably 10 times more plays than anything else on that album. I love the entire soundtrack. Unfortunately, I did see the Enchanted Tiki Room under new management. And I can't remember the actual details. But I, from what I remember in my head, you know, everyone, at least in my generation, I'm sure with yours too, you know, we know our parents had a favorite attraction. My dad's favorite attraction was Pirates of the Caribbean. I remember on our first trips, it was the first thing we had to do when we get there is go ride Pirates of the Caribbean. That was his ride. That's what we had to do. For some reason, my mom's attraction was the Enchanted Tiki Room. She liked the birds. You know, my mom's the type of person, she likes the train, likes the riverboat, likes the tiki room. She likes the sitting and just enjoying what's happening around. And, you know, I'm not sure if she just got painted that way or if that's actually the truth. I should have called her up before we did this episode, but it must have been our trip that we took in 2000. So 2 years after under new management came in, our first time back in a few years, we went to see the Tiki Room because, you know, that was my mom's attraction, and it was clearly different. And I can still remember, and I don't want to say this in a mean way, but the embarrassment of sitting in there being a part of this show that just did not flow together at all. It's, you know, Zazu is a great, great character. Iago's a great, great character in their respective movies. But in this attraction, it just didn't work at all. And then throwing Oa in there as well, too, just made it all so much more bizarre. And, you know, thank goodness for Oa, because now we have a delicious drink named after Oa at Trader Sam's. And of course in Grog Grotto we have Oa. I don't know if that's a spoiler for the next part of the story, but we do have Oa in there, a non-working version of Oa. So, you know, there, take the good with the bad, but the mixture of pop songs in this show with still having the Tiki Room in there and then mixing in like Friend Like Me in there, it just, nothing really came together. A terrible show.
Yeah, I just thought, oh, what were they thinking? I saw it once and I refused to ever see it again.
Yeah, I don't believe.
It was so bad. And it was ingrained in my memory. I just thought it was terrible. Yeah, and a little of Iago's voice goes a long way.
Yeah. No, we all know Gilbert Gottfried is, you know, he's got a very distinctive voice in everything he's done, you know, throughout his career. I've tried listening to his podcast multiple times because I enjoy the guests he gets on his show. But then his voice is still just a part of it. But yeah, I don't believe we did it after that very first time. I have watched it back multiple times on YouTube to give it another shot, to really try to understand it, see more of a Oa, see what they were going for in there. And it's just awful. So bad.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. Well, in a touch of irony, a fire in the show building really did scorch Iago in 2011, quite badly.
Mm-hmm.
The Imagineers must have taken this as a sign from the Tiki Gods or from Walt Disney and closed the attraction for refurbishment. It opened a year later with a shorter version of the original Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room. So, Craig, do you think this version of Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room holds up, or is it an attraction that's past its prime?
You know, I will put aside my adoration for Tiki Room, and I will really come at this from a, a objective opinion, but I do think, even though that makes no sense, I think it does hold up still to this day. I don't think it's past its prime. While I know definitely older kids, teenagers and a lot of adults may be, not as impressed with it. And they will look at it and, judge stuff like being able to hear the hydraulics, hear the clicks, all the little problems with it. The tiki's in there never seem to work, despite however many rehabs the ride goes through, the attraction goes through. It just never works. But it's still, if you watch kids in there and how their eyes light up when the birds start singing and then the flowers come to life, that is how you should see the attraction.
Mm-hmm.
And, for me, it's the music just caught me. I think it was a combination of experiencing Trader Sam's and really just kind of falling back in love with Adventureland. All of it came together, and that's why the Tiki Room means so much to me now. But then you go in there and you wonder, who is this for? Just go in there and plant yourself next to, a really young kid, a toddler, and see how excited they get watching all of this magic come to life. It's in that is why I think it still holds up. It still has a purpose. It still belongs.
Well, our granddaughter, from the first time we took her to Disneyland when she was around 2, this was her favorite attraction. Yeah. She always had to see the singing birds, as she called it. We'd have to go multiple times sometimes.
Oh,
and she still loves it. And yeah, for me, this is a must-do.
It is.
Attraction for the historic reasons and just it's delightful. And they cleaned up ours, brought it back to its pristine shape again. It is a little shorter. They removed the Offenbach piece. But I do prefer ours at Disneyland just because we have more of the original show elements.
And it's much more intimate. Mm-hmm. And yep. The fountain is just
right.
Amazing. A very simple effect. But it's Disneyland's wins by far. But Walt Disney World has made progress in the fact that in the past year we can now take Dole Whips in ours too. So, right. Every little bit helps.
Mm-hmm. Now, from October 1971 until late 1973, Adventureland ended at the Tropical Serenade building because there was no Caribbean Plaza or Pirates of the Caribbean attraction. The only way for guests to move on to Frontierland without backtracking toward the Treehouse portal was next to the Sunshine Tree Terrace, which is not where it is today.
Yes. Yeah. So. I actually, it's probably as good a time as any to bring that up. The Sunshine Tree Terrace is... sorry, I had a little bit of audio issues there. The Sunshine Tree Terrace is actually... now moved over to where Aloha Isle was, and they have been completely swapped out. So Sunshine Tree Terrace, if you
are unaware of what that is, well, that is the that's the place where you're going to want to get your citrus swirl, which is very popular dessert. And Aloha Isle was home of the Dole Whip, and it just made more sense to move Aloha Isle over to the bigger location of Sunshine Tree Terrace because, well, you know, you can serve more Dole Whips, and now it's even more convenient because you can take your Dole Whip straight into the Tiki Room, and that's synergy for you. So,
yeah.
Yes, nowadays swapped, but Sunshine Tree Terrace, for some people, including me, it is the it's the quick service stand that is right beside the exit to the Tiki Room.
Mm-hmm. Right. So now what I'm talking about is where its original location is, which is where Aloha Isle is.
Yes.
So back there, there was, in those early years, there was no barricade between the Sunshine Tree Terrace and the Tiki Tropic Shop that was there. Instead, there was an open and uncovered walkway that led into Frontierland between the Country Bear Jamboree and the Frontier Trading Post buildings. But this made for bad show because guests standing in the center of Adventureland could see a Liberty Square riverboat sail by in the distance. This was not remedied until 1976, 3 years after Caribbean Plaza opened and provided a more continuous link into Frontierland along the border of the Walt Disney World Railroad line. The addition of a planter wall and roof structure was constructed next to the Sunshine Tree Terrace, providing sort of a barrier between the two lands that still exists today.
Yeah. And it really does separate it out and distinguish the two different portals, mm-hmm. which is very nice. There are several areas going through our Magic Kingdom that don't do a good job of breaking up the different lands. But with this addition, granted, I didn't see it before, but with it being there, it really does, because you have to cross almost through that tunnel to get mm-hmm. into the next land, and it's very effective.
Now, when Walt Disney World's Adventureland opened on October 1st, 1971, there was no Pirates of the Caribbean, because the plan for Phase 2 of the Magic Kingdom was to build the Western River Expedition in Frontierland. This was designed by Mark Davis. The Western River Expedition would have featured a boat ride similar to Pirates of the Caribbean within the Mesa-themed show building, taking guests through scenes in the Old West with a runaway train roller coaster surrounding the Mesa. And on top of the Mesa would be a hiking trails, a Pueblo Indian village, and a pack mule attraction. Now, the Imagineers planned to build a Western River Expedition rather than a Pirates of the Caribbean attraction because they believed people on the East Coast would not be as interested in pirates because they were so much a part of Florida's history and legend. When the Magic Kingdom opened, however, the complaints poured in from guests. Where are the pirates? And this attraction had been heavily promoted by Walt Disney on his television series, and Disney executives quickly realized there was a high demand for an East Coast version of Pirates of the Caribbean. Due to guest demand, Dick Nunes, executive vice president of Walt Disney World and Disneyland, quickly authorized the construction of Pirates of the Caribbean attraction for the Magic Kingdom. And this would ultimately result in the cancellation of the Western River Expedition. To accommodate Pirates of the Caribbean, Adventureland was expanded to create an area named Caribbean Plaza. When Pirates of the Caribbean opened on December 15th, 1973, most of Caribbean Plaza was not ready to open. This left the plaza as just an entry portal to the attraction. By the summer of 1974, the House of Treasure, Plaza del Sol Caribe, La Princesa de Cristal, the Golden Galleon, and El Pirata y El Perico, and I apologize to our Spanish-speaking listeners, these were all open, and together they helped to build better defined the theme of Caribbean Plaza. Now, within a year, the Caribbean Arcade opened. Caribbean Plaza now provided a transition from a Spanish plaza on the northwest side of Adventureland to the Spanish-influenced architectural styles of the 1850s American Southwest in the southwest corner of Frontierland. Now, the Magic Kingdom's version of Pirates of the Caribbean offers a much more elaborate queue themed to a Spanish fortress. The facade of the attraction is inspired by the El Castillo de San Juan del Moro, a Spanish fort on the coast of Puerto Rico outside the capital of San Juan. Inside, the sets of the show scenes are consistent with the Spanish colonial architecture of Cuba and the Dominican Republic. Now, the queue is beneath the fortress, and guests enter through an open-air ground floor before walking underneath two archways, along a wide cellar corridor and into the fortress. And once inside, the queue splits in two. The original path to the right leads to the fort and past a prison scene where two skeleton pirates are forever playing chess. Mark Davis left his humorous signature and love for chess in this scene. The skeletons playing chess are at an impasse. Mark Davis researched past Masters tournaments for a non-win outcome, and he placed the chess pieces so the skeletons would be pondering their next move for eternity. And the left queue takes a different path, with less theming, to board the bateau, which is the name of the boats, on the opposite side of the loading area. Now, once on board, guests sail immediately into the grotto, then drop down a single waterfall into the battle scene. The Blue Bayou and scenes of Cursed Treasure that follow the waterfall in Disneyland's version were not included in the Magic Kingdom's version, as is about half of the interior of the Burning City. At the end of the Magic Kingdom attraction, guests disembark their bateau after the jail and final treasure scene, and the bateau are transported up the final lift backstage. At Disneyland, guests remain in the bateau and go up the waterfall before disembarking at the loading station. Now, Craig, before we sail through the multiple refurbishments Pirates of the Caribbean has undergone, is this attraction on your must-do list?
Yeah, it is. You know, it's the nostalgia part of it. It's the fact that, you know, I was so used to, as I said earlier, always doing it as our first attraction when we came down on vacations, because it was my dad's favorite attraction. And, you know, I think that even still holds up when we were, you know, we would do it at, obviously, when we came to Walt Disney World, but even when I got to go to Disneyland with him last summer, you know, we experienced a lot of attractions, a lot of stuff he didn't get to do, because it just wasn't around since the times he came as a kid, and then since our last family vacation out there. And after we got off Pirates of the Caribbean, it was just one of those things. Throughout the day, he just kept slowly dropping hints like, well, you know, if we get a chance to do it again, I'd like to, because, you know, it's just that good. And, you know, part of it for me is that that's ingrained into me. I love the attraction. I love the music in it. You know, everything that Exitencio did with it, the playfulness in the characters, just everything about it, it just hits. So even if I don't like the current changes that have been made in Disney World in terms of Fast Pass Plus really screwing up the lines and making them unnecessarily longer than they need to be, even if I don't agree with stuff like that, it still is ultimately, if I would vacation here as a regular tourist, it would absolutely be a must do multiple times. And, you know, even as a local, if I get that opportunity, if I see that line is 20 minutes or less, I'm in it.
Yeah. You know, for me, at Disneyland, this is usually my very favorite attraction. To me, it epitomizes everything that Walt Disney stood for and that Imagineering stood for. It is the quintessential Disney attraction in terms of storytelling, theming, detail. You know, I don't think there's another attraction that tops it. The Magic Kingdom for me, however, because of the differences we talked about, that is not on my must-do list when I visit the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it just pales in comparison.
Oh, yeah, no, for me, I totally understand. As a Californian, and someone who goes to Disneyland very often, more often than you come out to Walt Disney World, I get it. You know, we have so many more attractions in different parks. Skip this inferior attraction. So yeah, I totally understand that 100%. You know, I've heard the greatest things about the Pirates of the Caribbean in Disneyland Paris, and I've heard all the stories of how amazing that is. I just, you know, in my end, obviously with the Pirates in Shanghai, we've heard the infinite amount of praise from that, but I just don't understand how anything could quite be as special as that Disneyland Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, and what adds to its speciality in Disneyland too is it's the last, you know, attraction Walt, you know, really worked on.
Yeah.
So anyway. Well, no real changes came to Pirates of the Caribbean until 1997, when the scene with the pirates chasing the women of Port Royal was altered. Following the refurbishment, instead of the pirates chasing the women for nefarious reasons, the scene now showed the women chasing the pirates. The other scene change affected the pooped pirate. Now, the pooped pirate is the pirate sitting on the barrels near the women who are chasing the pirates. Originally, he told his dog how he was too tired to continue to chase the women, whilst the blonde woman hid in a barrel behind him. In 1997, his dialogue was changed, so he now told his dog about his treasure map. This map says X marks the spot, but I be seeing no X's afore me. The woman in the barrel behind him now held a small treasure chest, apparently hiding in the barrel to keep it safe. Following the success of the Pirates of the Caribbean film franchise, the decision was made to add characters from the film to the attraction. In 2006, Pirates of the Caribbean was closed for refurbishment, and when it reopened, guests saw the following changes. The attraction fort facade was slightly altered. New props and a new black sail entrance were added to the attraction. The pirate Barker Bird Peg-Legged Pete, who had previously talked to guests outside the entrance, had left in search of calmer seas. He later perched himself in the pirate room in the World of Disney shop at Downtown Disney. The final line of the safety spiel was changed from "Now off with ya" to "Prepare to make sail." Davy Jones now appeared on Waterfall just before the attraction's drop. He warned guests, "Aye, but they do, so says I, Davy Jones," in response to the famous "Dead men tell no tales" being repeated in the background. The talking skull with crossed swords that warned guests about the attraction's drop was removed. I missed that one at Disneyland because it set the scene so well for the big reveal that was coming. You know, you've seen the treasure, you know, and and what was going to happen to you. That it completely changed the mood for that scene. In the pirates' ship battle scene, a Barbossa now captains the Wicked Wench. The pirate captain declares he is trying to find Captain Jack Sparrow. The cannons in the battle were altered to fire smoke and compressed air. In the scene where the pirate captain is shown dunking the mayor, he now demands to know Captain Jack Sparrow's whereabouts. Captain Jack Sparrow was now seen nearby, hiding in a dress shop doorway. The pooped pirate was given a key and a treasure map. In the barrel behind him, Captain Jack Sparrow could now be seen spying on both items. The treasure room was completely redone. Captain Jack Sparrow now sits on a throne atop his captured treasure. So, Craig, are you a fan of the Pirates of the Caribbean film franchise?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer, yes. I was, I guess, the first one came out in 2003, so I would have been 16. So, I mean, I was like the perfect age for these movies. This was right when Johnny Depp was exploding, you know, Orlando Bloom was also doing everything with Lord of the Rings, so he was just massive. And let's face it, even to this day, Curse of the Black Pearl is just a fun adventure movie. I foresee it still being around in 50 years the same way as we talked about Swiss Family Robinson. It still has a presence to this day with Disney fans. I know Curse of the Black Pearl still will, and it, despite, you know, Disney trying to shove it down our throats at every possible cost. And I even love Dead Man's Chest. I go back and forth. While Curse of the Black Pearl is the classic, the quintessential Pirates movie, there are so many elements about Dead Man's Chest that I think it, depending on what day you ask me, I might say that's the better movie. You know, we won't talk about number three and number four so much.
Yeah,
but yes, I am. You know, I believe somewhere still at home I have like a 10-foot giant vinyl poster of the third movie somewhere at home that I got for some reason. You know, I was at Downtown Disney at the AMC. The night that Curse of the Black Pearl came out, we didn't even really know anything about it. Just found out that there was this Pirates of the Caribbean movie showing while we were in Disneyland. Went to it and just mesmerized, and it just, you know, it became this phenomenon for me, and like it did so many people out there. And so I have a lot of fond feelings about it. I don't know how. You know, we'll see with the next movie coming out very shortly here how it still remains a cultural thing with us. But, you know, it will always have meaning to the people who definitely grew up during the height of its popularity.
Now, what are your thoughts about the Imagineers reverse engineering this attraction to go from an original attraction to one based on a film franchise?
Oh, that's easier. I don't like it. The Jack Sparrow animatronics, I guess they're somewhat impressive. I know how technologically inventive they are, and I know that Johnny Depp was even surprised how similar it looked to him. I don't see that. It messes with a classic Disney attraction, and I don't think it adds to the story. You know, it literally is to just keep the movies relevant and keep Jack Sparrow relevant and keep sales to products happening. With an attraction, I feel like the only reason why you should update it or integrate a movie franchise in it is if it will truly help to add to the story or bring new life to it. And Pirates, it didn't do that for me. It didn't need new life added into it, and it didn't add to the story. Part of the reasons why, thank goodness, nothing ever happened to Haunted Mansion with the Eddie Murphy movie.
Yeah,
it just, you know, that's how I feel about it. I know a lot of people love it. It just bums me out. I think one day, eventually, we will get back to classic Pirates. When everything blows over, the next time Johnny Depp screws something up and they no longer want his face on an attraction, I think we will eventually get we'll get classic Pirates back, and I'm hoping for that day.
Yeah, I would like to see the classic one come back too. But the refurbishments didn't end with this. This popular attraction has seen more alterations than any other Magic Kingdom attraction. To coincide with the release of Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, Blackbeard, who is the main antagonist in the film, replaced the Davy Jones projection on the waterfall on May 20th, 2011. On September 19th, 2012, to tie in with International Talk Like a Pirate Day, Disney announced they would be adding another tie-in to On Stranger Tides to the attraction. On October 19th, guests could catch a glimpse of ghostly mermaids just after the waterfall. As the bateau float by, the mermaids can be seen in the water as Jolly Sailor Bold plays in the background. On the nearby beach scene, a mermaid skeleton was added.
Yeah, and I don't believe it's been a while since the last time we've seen any mermaids besides the one on the beach.
Yeah, I haven't noticed that effect in quite a while.
It actually was very cool. I remember one of the first video assignments I was given for the Diz was to go and to film it when they added the mermaids in. So that was neat, but yeah.
In 2015, Pirates of the Caribbean was closed yet again for another major refurbishment. This time the attraction was clean, repaired, and relit. Other changes included adding Davy Jones back onto the attraction's waterfall so he would rotate with Blackbeard, and the audio animatronics, including Barbossa, Jack Sparrow, and the Redhead, were redressed with new costumes. A few new effects were added, including new cannon effects, new lightning effects. The Drunk Pirate's whiskey was now being on fire. And new scents added throughout the attraction. And backstage, the attraction's ride system was updated. Now, Pirates of the Caribbean remains one of the most impressive musical animatronic displays in the theme park industry. More than 15 minutes, it's also one of the longest theme park rides in the world. This attraction has launched an entertainment empire with four films that have grossed billions of dollars, along with video games and books. Pirates of the Caribbean's signature song, Yo-Ho, Yo-Ho, A Pirate's Life for Me by Exotencio and George Bruins, is just as famous as the attraction itself. And Mark Davis left another signature on the attraction. As you pass the treasure room with Jack Sparrow, look for the family crest with the name Marco Deviso. He also expressed his love of chess again by placing rooks in the upper right and left corners of the crest. So, Craig, in this era of thrill rides and youngsters who desire shorter, faster, action-packed adventures, do you believe attractions like Pirates of the Caribbean that emphasize story and theme over action still have a place, or are they simply nostalgic?
It's a loaded question. You know, there is a level of nostalgia to it, but I do believe that attractions like Pirates still do have a strong place, and because of the depth of the story and theme that's there, you know, there are some attractions out there, and you know, I'll say like Tower of Terror, great story, great theme, but the scare is out front. You know, when you're walking down that street, you hear those screams. The closer you get, you start to see those doors open up. You see the people out there. You know what's happening with it. I can't tell you how many times, I'm sure you've seen the same thing at Disneyland at least once or twice, where there will be kids that know there's pirates inside there from the name and are terrified to find out what is actually happening in there. Of course, once you get in, it's not scary at all, unless you're afraid of water or a couple little drops, but it's just this great little adventure through. And but that's what, you know, I like the mystery behind Pirates, and a lot of these attractions that are like Pirates that emphasize the story and theme, they don't put right out front what the attraction is. It's not like Radiator Springs Racers, where you know, there is a story and theme to it, but you see those cars whizzing by you out front. you're mm-hmm. giving it away right there. There's that mystery, and that's why I think they have a place, because ultimately, what do we want to do? We want to figure out what's behind those closed doors, and rides like Pirates do that. Rides like Haunted Mansion do that, mm-hmm. and they are very important for that reason.
I agree, and it's interesting because, you know, even though Disney tries to do these exciting thrill ride attractions, they still keep coming back. They still like to the Little Mermaid attraction, yeah. to the Frozen attraction.
Yes.
And so they still come back to them. Maybe not the huge, long, grand attractions, but they're still adding Pirates of the Caribbean to the new theme parks.
Yeah.
So and versions of the Haunted Mansion. So I think these attractions still have a place.
Yeah. The only thing we need is for there to be a reemergence of Disney exploring original stories through their attractions. And
that would be nice.
But we know mm-hmm. the difficulties of that is that you mm-hmm. can't tie it into movies, and you're losing out on extra money.
Well, and the built-in audience isn't there, so then they're taking a risk.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, with all of the changes to Adventureland and the addition of Caribbean Plaza, the Imagineers managed to maintain the continuity of the realm's theme and design. This was not true when an attraction based on Disney's 1992 film Aladdin was added. This Dumbo-esque magic carpet ride called The Magic Carpets of Aladdin opened in May 2001. This new addition was squeezed into a spot in front of the Enchanted Tiki Room under new management. And the main difference between this attraction and Dumbo, besides the theme, is these ride vehicles seat up to 4 people, 2 rows of 2 people. The riders in front decide if the flying carpet will rise or fall, and the riders in the back determine the vehicle's pitch, if it's tilting forwards or backwards. Now, prior to this attraction's construction, references to the Middle East and Adventureland were very subtle. There were some hints of the region in the bazaar's melting pot rooftops and a few items of imported merchandise that linked to North Africa and the Fertile Crescent in a shop called the Magic Carpet, but it was not in a prominent location in Adventureland. The plaza for the Magic Carpets of Aladdin and surrounding shops are reimagined with Moroccan, Egyptian, and Persian themes of around 400 BC. Amongst the changes introduced were the scenic terraced pools that fed out of the Tiki Room's eastern outside wall were reduced to within just a few feet of the main building. Long-standing planters and palms that had lent shade to the area, including the one with the large rock head, sort of like from Easter Island, were removed. Open seating adjacent to the Sunshine Tree Terrace was eliminated. The architecture of several Adventureland Bazaar buildings were transformed into the Agrabah Bazaar. An original Magic Kingdom shop, Traders of Timbuktu, was replaced, and the buildings appeared to be made of thick, heavy clay walls in contrast to the surrounding Polynesian Caribbean theme buildings. The main shop was draped in blue and gold striped cloth to give the appearance of being in a large tent. Now, Craig, I am confident this area of Adventureland is definitely on your must-do list.
Well, of course, because I'm just frankly too lazy to go all the way around through Frontierland and then kind of pop in the back by Pirates of the Caribbean to enter Adventureland. This is one of those things that we've talked about a lot in the Disney realm of, they just kind of they missed it. They were a little bit too late with this. Had this change happened in 1993, right after the height of Aladdin, I believe my first trip that I can remember was in 92, so same year that Aladdin came out, 93, so in 1994, right after Lion King came out, while Aladdin was still fresh on our minds, if this would have been there, forget Dumbo. Magic Carpet of Aladdin would have been my go-to thing. I'm a kid who grew up in the Disney Renaissance. That's what it means to me. But because it wasn't there until way too late, 9 years after the movie came out, it's just irrelevant by that point in time. And, you know, I had all those years of riding Dumbo. And so now Dumbo is the nostalgia hub and spoke attraction for me, like so many people. And, it's granted the Magic Carpet of Aladdin does have a little bit of a fun twist to it, with the spitting camel and everything, but even though magic's in the title, it lacks magic.
Yeah, I just think thematically it's just an eyesore, whole thing.
And it's the closest we get to the Disneyland congestion is right through that area.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. I don't know. I would love it if they just finally said, we have the Astro Orbiter, we have Dumbo, the dueling Dumbos now. We don't need this anymore. I would just love for them to take it out.
Yep.
Or find another place for it. Throw it over Disney Hollywood Studios.
Take it out. Put in a nice, like, round restaurant. The quick service restaurant that could be placed right there. So you leave Jungle Cruise or you leave Tiki Room and you have this place you can go and sit and relax. And that sounds great to me.
Yeah. So, or a place to sit and enjoy your Dole Whip.
Yeah.
Over right there by the little aisle and all that. Yeah.
That'd even be good.
I just think they did a similar kind of thing less grand in our Adventureland at Disneyland, where the much loved Tahitian Terrace that had been closed for it was there, and they decided to retheme it as Aladdin's Oasis, and it was still a show, but you have our Tiki Room, the Polynesian theme, and then you had the Tahitian Terrace that then just blended right in to the Jungle Cruise. And now suddenly in between those two, we have this little Agrabah building sitting there. It makes absolutely no sense thematically.
And I think that's why I always avoid it, because it doesn't make sense to me why it is there.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense for the story or anything. So, but happily, there was another change that was more in keeping with the general theme of Adventureland, with roots in a popular classic attraction and a much beloved dining establishment. The Jungle Navigation Company Limited Skipper Canteen opened on December 16th, 2015, in the space that was formerly the Adventureland Veranda Restaurant, before becoming a meet and greet with Tinkerbell, which I'd never understood. Many of the Dorothea Redmond interiors remain intact, and portions of the restaurant are 1971 opening day originals. Like the world-famous Jungle Cruise, the restaurant on which it is based includes both a heavy dose of storytelling and an emphasis on light humor. The food draws on the attraction's African, Asian, and South American locales. And the backstory is that the tour's operator's owner, Alberta Falls, has repurposed her company's headquarters into a restaurant to generate additional revenue. In doing so, she allows customers to go behind the scenes of the wacky business and interact with the skippers. Alberta Falls is the third-generation owner of the company, started by her grandfather, Dr. Albert Falls, and, of course, Jungle Cruise passengers may recognize that name. And the Jungle Navigation Company, which was originally a cargo shipping company, when the cargo business took a downturn, Alberta decided to open up cruises to passengers at the suggestion of one of her skippers. The success of the Jungle Cruise business was so great that Alberta decided to open up the home offices to Hungry Cruise passengers pre- or post-cruise. The restaurant includes three dining rooms. The cruise mess hall is the largest one and includes wall hangings and photos, documents, native musical instruments, and other expedition mementos. Memorabilia from the Falls family personal belongings they brought over from England decorate the Falls family parlor. Dr. Falls was a member of the Society of Adventurers and Explorers, or SEA, and he used to host fellow members in the once-hidden secret meeting room of the SEA. This room was accessed by a secret panel in the library, and diners in this room are treated to artifacts from this mysterious organization. Members of the Adventurers Club in Downtown Disney will feel pangs of nostalgia in this dining room. Now, as with their Jungle Cruise counterparts, the skippers who double as servers at the canteen have the same banter as they do on the Jungle Cruise. For example, after distributing menus to a table, a server might say, "I'd like to point out some of the highlights of the restaurant." And then they might point up to the overhead fixtures. "There's a light. There's another one. That one is pretty high." In a typewritten letter attached to the menu, Alberta Falls briefly explains the history of the Jungle Navigation Company and the restaurant. She concludes it by writing, "We enjoy having you and we hope you enjoy being had. Please relax, enjoy your meal, then get out." Her postscript adds, "I'm sorry, that was rude. Please get out." There are a lot of details to be seen throughout the restaurant. For example, during your visit, examine the books in the library for titles like The Illustrated Guide to Radio Broadcasting by the skipper behind the voice of the jungle you hear in the Jungle Cruise queue, Albert A.W.O.L., AWOL. Also on the shelf is Boat Evacuation Procedures by Cap Size, Great Characters of World Literature by J. Lasseter, Meeting Royalty by Marty Sklar, Crooning Flowers by Sherman and Sherman, Songs of the Tiki Bird by Wally Bogue, Albert the Monkey, who is the pet monkey of Henry Mystic, even has a book on the shelf along with books written by Mystic, and M.A. Pleasure, founder of Pleasure Island. And of course, Henry Mystic, for those of you who are familiar with Hong Kong Disneyland, know of Mystic Manor. Also, of course, there's the classic title True Life Adventures by W.E.D., Walter Elias Disney. Note the angle of The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling. This book is on the movable bookshelf, the one that would allow entrance into the secret meeting room of SEA. So we can only assume that this is the book that members of the SEA would pull to open the wall. On the second floor of the cruise mess hall, look for the offices of the three Imagineers who were instrumental in designing the Jungle Cruise. Skipper Bill Evans, who is responsible for the landscaping of the Disney theme parks. Skipper Mark Davis, who is responsible for the humorous vignettes. And Skipper Harper Goff, who was a fan of the film The African Queen and designed the look and theme of the original attraction. So, Craig, have you dined at the Skipper's Canteen?
I have. I've been lucky enough to eat there twice, and I love it. It doesn't even matter how delicious the food is. You know, between the little hidden details throughout there, and the fact that the servers carry over that same humor that you would find at the Jungle Cruise. It all works together perfectly for a great experience. The only thing I think they're truly missing out on is that, you know, it is the Magic Kingdom. So despite now that rules have changed, then they do have a limited alcohol menu. That you can purchase from. The only thing that this place truly is missing is a bar to sit and relax at. This restaurant feels like it should have it. You know, I'm glad it doesn't. I'm in the anti-alcohol in the Magic Kingdom side, you know, but hypocritical because I have partaked in wine over at a new Fantasyland restaurant that remains nameless. But yeah, I get a kick out of this place. It's really beautiful. I would eat there every single time if I could put up with doing a full service meal every time I went into the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I like the food. It's a very exotic menu. So for people who have less adventurous palates, you this might not be the place for you. But spend time just exploring and looking at everything on the walls, from the, you know, from the bulletin boards to you know, a lot of the items that we've mentioned, to light fixtures, to everything.
Yeah,
I mean, it's really great.
You're right. It is exotic, but I don't think it's like, it's not absurdly exotic. The menu items might sound a little bizarre, sound different than anything you've had before, but at the end of the day, a lot of the dishes are still, you know, you can find a plainness to them. So, I mean, we've at least on the Diz, we've said over and over again, don't be afraid of this place. Mm-hmm. There, you will still find something, even if you are the pickiest eater in here. And it's just one of those restaurants you have to see. So just, mm-hmm. you know, face your fears and get in there.
You're going to have to tell that to my wife.
I'll
because I can't get her in there.
Next time we talk, yeah, I'll yell at her about it. Good.
Now, there are some other features unique to the Magic Kingdom's Adventureland. One is the citrus swirl, and the other is the adorable orange bird. Now, Walt Disney Productions entered into negotiations with the Florida Citrus Commission, or FCC, and they were represented as the Florida citrus growers in the park, for an FCC-sponsored Walt Disney World attraction in 1967. A contract was signed on October 22, 1969, formalizing the FCC's underwriting of a tropical bird show at a cost of $3 million. And, of course, they went on to sponsor the Tropical Serenade. The following year, WED Enterprises created the Orange Bird character to serve as the FCC's official mascot in promotional campaigns. Now, the official birth date of the Orange Bird was in 1970, and this mascot was designed to be fairly simple. The bird would be orange and have a head shaped like the citrus fruit that he was meant to sell, and green leaves for wings. However, though the design of the Orange Bird was pretty straightforward, he still needed a gimmick. So whilst other Disney characters like Mickey Mouse can talk and interact with others, the Orange Bird's defining characteristic would be that he was unable to speak, squeak, or even make the smallest sound. Instead, the Orange Bird could only communicate through orange-tinted smoke that would display his thoughts. Unsurprisingly, the Orange Bird thought a lot about oranges and the state of Florida.
What?
Yeah. But he soon developed a catchphrase of sorts. Whenever something was pleasing to the Orange Bird, his thought bubble would say "nice" in all caps. They crafted a nice backstory for him that was told in a song by the Sherman Brothers and sung by Anita Bryant. In 1968, the Florida Citrus Commission had signed with Bryant, a former Miss America contestant, as their official spokesperson. 3 years later, she was teamed with the Orange Bird in publicity photos and commercials, most of which she ended with the line, "From the Sunshine Tree." As a semicircular outcropping from the larger Sunshine Pavilion's north end, the Sunshine Tree Terrace continued the South Seas architecture with its torch-bearing tiki sentries holding flames along the roofline. And even though oranges do grow in Polynesia, the Sunshine Tree behind the terrace's orange-tiled counter was 100% Floridian perennial. It grew from the rear counter and rose to the ceiling, where it formed a leafy canopy over the serving area. Naturally, it was loaded with artificial oranges and orange blossoms. The leaves were made of translucent green plastic. Tottering on a perch near the base of the tree was the Orange Bird himself, a correctly sized version of the bird, as opposed to the larger character who would playfully interact with guests in the courtyard. After the Anita Bryant campaign was dropped in the late 70s, the Orange Bird had a solo career. Into the early 1980s, he became a citrus icon for the state of Florida, where he appeared in television advertisements, print media, and on lots of souvenir items. But to meet the Orange Bird, you still had to visit the Sunshine Tree Terrace at the Magic Kingdom. Now, after Disney and the FCC ended their contract in 1986, his identity became increasingly less tied to the citrus industry itself and more closely linked to the state of Florida as an iconic character. And a majority of the merchandise released with his image was accompanied by the name Florida in capital letters. Although Orange Bird merchandise remained a staple of Citrus Grove stands and tourist area t-shirt shops well into the 1990s, he was fading from public view. Two later developments renewed interest in the Orange Bird. The first was that Delta's low-cost Song Airlines, launched in April 2003, offered passengers the opportunity to hear the Orange Bird song as part of their in-flight Disney musical menu. And although Song folded back into Delta in 2005, enough people had heard the tune in 2 years to create a lot of online discussions about the Orange Bird and what he was. The second is that Tokyo Disneyland began to produce its own unique Orange Bird merchandise line in 2004, about 30 years after the nation's kawaii, or cute, as embodied by characters such as Sanrio's Hello Kitty or Pokemon's Pikachu movement began. So in 1996, April 14th was christened Orange Day in Japan, a holiday where people exchange citrus fruits along with objects of their affection. By the summer of 2006, more Orange Bird merchandise had debuted in Japan than had been created over the full span of the character's career in the United States. The Orange Bird soon returned to appearing regularly on merchandise in the United States, as well as at both Walt Disney World and Disneyland, which confused people at Disneyland because they'd never seen this Orange Bird in the park. On April 17th, 2012, the Orange Bird finally made a return flight to his home at the Sunshine Tree Terrace. And that is where we end our journey through the historic jungles of Adventureland. So, Craig, are you an Orange Bird fan?
I am a minor Orange Bird fan. The first time I really knew anything about Orange Bird was when they started adding the Orange Bird little souvenir sipper. At Sunshine Tree Terrace. And I will still kick myself to this day. It's one of those souvenir cups that I just kept putting off getting. Like, eh, I'll get it next time, which is really sad as a local. And, of course, then when I was finally ready to make the purchase, they no longer sell them. And I think I'm still slightly bitter about that. So I do have some Orange Bird stuff here and there. I have the towels, and I have my Orange Bird magic band, courtesy of Disney Parks blog, and a few little random things here and there. And I love the character. It is, you know, it is Florida to me, seeing the Orange Bird. And I love everything it stands for. I love, you know, the whole cult of citrus movement that's online regarding the citrus swirl in Orange Bird. It's fantastic. I'm glad that he's had such a resurgence, but you know, I want to get fully into him. I just also know what that will cost me in buying every little thing that goes along with it. Yeah. So that's why I say minor fan.
Yeah. I have an Orange Bird figurine in our kitchen, you know, when he got reintroduced. It was a remake of, you know, an original figurine that they had back in the day. And I remember him. I remember him when I visited the park as a boy and he was wandering around and didn't quite figure out what he was. Because we didn't have, you know, California, we have our own citrus, you know, industry. So even though we saw the commercials, Anita Bryant, you know, the commercials were on TV out in California. So
I have to imagine in the near future, we will see the return of the Orange Bird walk around character. You know, it's everything is pointing towards retro Disney with the merchandise that's being created, with the fan base who's asking for more and more of it. So I think that's one thing that will happen.
Yeah, I was surprised when they brought back the Orange Bird, back in 2012. They didn't bring back the character.
Yeah, no, I know. It's inevitable. You know, the same thing goes with Figment. Figment is getting ready to make the big leap back into it. Granted, yes, Figment has only left Epcot for a very temporary amount of time, always been, but always still the soul of that park in a way, and an iconic character. But, you know, Figment is about to blow up bigger than he's been since back in the 80s, and I think Orange Bird is heading towards the same path.
Yeah, I hope so. And I hope there are bigger and better things for Figment. He deserves a better attraction, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Now, and yes, with apologies to our colleague and friend, Kathy Werling. Now that we've completed our exploration of Adventureland, do you believe that this land still has the same relevancy today as it did on opening day, especially since Disney's Animal Kingdom opened with its live animals, real jungle safari, more authentic theming, and thrill rides?
Absolutely. You mentioned it when you discussed the Walt Disney, the passage in regards to Tomorrowland, Tomorrowland in regards to Adventureland. You mentioned romance and mystery. And those are two things that just aren't in Animal Kingdom. Those two things, I don't see how they can be fully wrapped into a park that is so dedicated on being completely accurate to the countries and the locations that they're trying to explore and trying to recreate. The romanticism, you know, that brings along with it a sort of fiction, and you can only get that in a place like the Magic Kingdom. You can't get that in a park that's based solely on reality, you know, minus the blue people who are invading and the dinosaurs. Well, dinosaurs are real, but the blue people in particular, you know, that's hurting the reality of that park. But in terms of the African and the Asian sections of Animal Kingdom, they are just so realistic that they are a great companion piece to Adventureland.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, it definitely has its place.
Yeah.
So, and now many books, films, articles, interviews, and lectures were sourced for this episode of Connecting with Walt, including Since the World Began, Walt Disney World, The First 25 Years by Jeff Curdy, A Historical Tour of Walt Disney World, Volume 1 by Andrew Kisti, The Hidden Magic of Walt Disney World by Suzanne Vaness, Walt Disney World, The First Decade by Walt Disney Productions, some websites, Widen Your World website, the Mickey Wiki, and the Disney Food Blog. Well, this brings us to the end of our first season for 2017. Craig and I hope you have enjoyed our adventurous explorations this month, and we'll come back for more in April. So, Craig, if our listeners can't wait until April, where can they see you on the Diz Unplugged network of shows?
As always, you can find me Tuesdays on the Disney World edition of the Diz Unplugged, Thursdays on the Universal edition of the Diz Unplugged, sometimes on Fridays with Diz Pop, sometimes on Mondays with the Dreams Unlimited Travel Show. I am all over the place. And then, of course, you can always find me on social media, Facebook. Well, not so much Facebook. I stay off that for the most part. But feel free to stalk me anytime you want on Twitter. I am at Teleclaster. And, yeah, that's all the places until we meet again in April.
Definitely. And you can find me every Sunday night on the Diz Unplugged podcast, Disneyland Edition, with my good friends Tom Bell, Nancy Johnson, Mary Jo Malotta-Willey, and Tony Spitale, where we have lots of fun talking about Walt's park that started it all, and all Southern California theme parks, the Walt Disney Family Museum, which is my beat, and even more Disney history. Listen to us live on Mixlr, Sundays at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, Disneyland Time. You can download our two weekly shows from iTunes each Monday. If you would like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studio, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes at www.disunplug.com, and look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings. You can send me messages at michael@wdwinfo.com. And on Twitter, I'm at mbowling121. Facebook, I'm Michael Bowling. Instagram, Michael Bowling the Diz. Thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother, Roy.